Okay, today's contemporary halacha shiur is given by Rabbi Dr. Ari Reichman. Rabbi Reichman is a Muslim of our yeshiva and a professor of emergency medicine, I think, at Einstein Medical School and a practicing physician and a well-known speaker about medical halacha. So, b'chavad, Rabbi Reichman.
Shkoyach, thank you very much, Rabbi Orlian. A pleasure and a schus to be here with you gentlemen today. We are going to talk about a topic of medical halacha. Of course, there are many topics in medical halacha that we could discuss. I'd like to begin with the following story. They tell the story of a scientist that approached HaKadosh Baruch Hu, approached God and said, God, we live in quite an amazing age. We've accomplished a tremendous amount. End-of-life treatment, beginning-of-life treatment, infertility, genetics, cloning, to such an extent that we can create man just like you did at the beginning. And you know what, God? We don't really need you anymore. We can do everything you can do. So God turns to the scientist and said, you can create man. How do you do such a thing? So the scientist says, well, we take some dirt, we bring it to the laboratory, we inject some enzymes into it. So God says, sounds great, why don't you show me? So the scientist proceeds to bend down and pick up the dirt, and God says, no, you get your own dirt. And in fact, the scientists today believe that they can control every dimension of life, from beginning of life to end of life. We're going to be talking about beginning of life. We're going to be talking about manipulations that can be done today to prevent the birth of children with genetic diseases. Genetics is one of the most extraordinary areas of discovery in our lifetimes, and it's really proceeding at an exponential pace. That's the fascinating thing about medical halacha. What we will be discussing today, I won't say will be obsolete in a couple years from now, but will be significantly updated in a couple years from now. It used to be, you know, just to give you a little perspective about how slow the wheels of change were in the past. I'm sure you gentlemen are learning the Rambam probably on a daily basis, if not a very frequent basis. You're learning the some one of the halachic material written by the Rambam. The Rambam also, as you may know, is a physician, and the Rambam wrote on medicine. We have extant the works of the Rambam in medicine. They were written in Arabic. They've been translated into Hebrew, translated into English. One of the works of medicine that the Rambam wrote on was a perush on the works of Hippocrates. Perush la'avukrat. Now, when did Hippocrates live? For 5 points. Hippocrates lived in the 5th century before the Common Era. When did the Rambam live? The 12th century. For 1,700 years, there hadn't been much development in the field of medicine, such that when the Rambam was writing his perush, he was writing on Hippocrates, and in fact, until the 18th century, pretty much, medicine really hadn't evolved too much. For millennia, medicine hadn't really evolved. Today, medicine is evolving at a dizzying pace, far more rapidly than ever in the history of mankind. And in fact, it's not unlikely that when we leave this room, you know, I'll hear on the radio on the way back home, or you'll read the newspaper in the New York Times if there's some other major discovery. So the challenge of you Rabbanim in this generation is really, in this particular area, is really to keep up and to keep contact and to keep dialogue with the scientists and with the physicians, so that if you do encounter areas of psak that relate to medical halacha, that you are you're getting the latest information and not relying on old information. So as we said, today we're going to be talking about genetics. And here you have a cartoon. An angel is approaching God and says, God, the human genome code has been unraveled. So God says, those lousy hackers, now I have to change the password. And in fact, we are really exploring the genetic code in ways which were never understood in the past. And here you have a beautiful illustration of the Hebrew letters through the DNA. But there are interesting parallels to the Sefer Torah and the human genome. They're both codes of letters which encode a tremendous amount of information. They're also codes that are that if the letters are deleted or if the letters are added, it can create problems. So, for example, in the human genome, if there's a deletion or an addition to the genome, it can cause potential problems. And the same thing in a Sefer Torah, if there's a Mole or a Chaser, the Mole or Chaser could potentially create a psul in the Sefer Torah. I was actually thinking just recently that that the Sefer Torah, one of the interesting things in the Sefer Torah is that there's no vowels in the Sefer Torah. That you can read a word in many different ways. There's a Masorah as to how to read the word. And I thought that an interesting parallel, Bizman Azeh, is that even the genetic code, which has letters, you know, there's only four letters in the genetic code, but even the genetic code can be read differently for different people based on an entire new field, which is called epigenetics, which we're not going to discuss so much today. But people who have the same DNA in code for the same potential, same enzymes, might actually express those things differently based on, if you will, how the enzymes are read and based on the genetic makeup of that individual and other factors. So there's a lot of fascinating parallels. Some have actually pointed out the fact that the very letters of the Hebrew alphabet are similar in shape to chromosomes. And you have here, this reads from right to left. So this is the Aleph, this is the Beis, this is the Gimel, this is the Dalet. So you see there's a very fascinating relationship between the Sefer Torah and the chromosomes and genetics. What I'd like to do today is, in this basic overview outline, I'd like to discuss some genetics, first of all, in halachic literature and rabbinic literature of the past, starting from the Chumash moving onwards. Then we'll move up into the 20th and 21st century and talk about a number of different areas where genetics has halachic ramifications, and there are many. And we will see them, including DNA testing, including population genetics, including at the end a brief discussion about the Cohen gene, which you may have heard about, and its potential halachic ramifications. So let's begin with allusions to genetics in the Torah as we move our way into the 20th and 21st century. Last week's Parsha Ve'elo told us Yitzchak ben Avram, Avram holy is Yitzchak, the famous Rashi, that in fact Sarah and Avram were infertile for a long period of time, and it was only after Avram visited Avimelech and Sarah spent time with Avimelech that lo and behold she became pregnant. So the nations of the world might have thought that when Sarah became pregnant, then maybe she became pregnant from Avimelech. So Rashi says, "Ayidei shekasav akasav Yitzchak ben Avram huzkak lomar Avram holy Yitzchak l'fishayu late sani ador omrim me'avi melech nisavr Sarah, that Sarah really became pregnant from Avimelech. Therefore, shari kama shanim shah soim Avram v'lo nisavrim, and because she was infertile for many years, ma'asa Kosh Baruch, what did Kosh Baruch do? Tsar klester panim shel Yitzchak domel Avram. What did he do? He created the likeness of Yitzchak was absolutely identical to the likeness of Avraham." So, and Rabbi Jonathan Sachs has a beautiful essay expounding on this idea that, in essence, this was the first. This is an experiment of cloning. That Kadosh Baruch Hu created a clone. Yitzchak really was a clone of Avraham. But how did this experiment pan out? So the Gemara tells us, "Ad Avraham lo yazikna kol dechazi le'Avraham amar ha'Yitzchak kol dechazi le'Yitzchak amar ha'Avraham." So when they were walking around the face of the earth, people, because they were literally identical, they were clones of each other, people confused them. People come to visit Avraham, they thought it was Yitzchak, they come to Yitzchak, they thought it was Avraham, and it created a tremendous confusion. So until this point in history, the Gemara tells us, aging didn't exist. Chronological aging existed, but physical aging did not. So people would live for however many years they would live, but they wouldn't. Their bodies wouldn't age, at least their face wouldn't age, their physical appearance, their visage wouldn't age. So Avraham asked of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, make me age. That's why it says, Avraham Zaken Babayamim, in order that there should be a differentiation between me and my son. So that was the origin of the Zikna, yes.
People didn't physically age, and how is there this whole thing with Avraham and Sarah? They became old, and then she was able to.
They became chronologically old. Chronologically old, yes. So they became, the years were old. So her body she went through menopause, and she didn't have children. Okay. So there was physiological aging, but not external manifestations of aging. But that same Gemara, by the way, says that until Yaakov, there was no sickness in the world. And that until that period of time, people would die, I think, with a sneeze, the Medrash says. I think it's the Yalkut Shimoni says they would die with a sneeze. But with Yaakov Avinu, the concept of sickness and evolution from sickness till death was introduced into the world. Also a fascinating phenomenon, which many of you probably didn't give second thought to, is the relationship between Yaakov and Esav in utero. Now we know by Yisrael Tzitzuha, Bonim B'Kirbo, and what do we know? This is obviously a rhetorical question. You all know the answer to this, but what did Esav hold on to prevent Yaakov from exiting the womb? It says, Akev Esav, he held on to his heel. So the question is, that scientists have pondered, is how is it possible in utero for Esav to hold on to Yaakov's heel? Because each fetus is enclosed in an amniotic sac. Right? Unless they were identical twins. And if they're identical twins, they could be within the same amniotic sac. There'd be monozygotic twins, and there'd be a monoamniotic, which means they would have one amniotic sac, and they would be within the amniotic sac. And most people don't really care about the answer to this question. But it's an interesting shaila. How was it possible for him to grab onto the heel physically if they were two separate children? So some actually theorize that maybe Yaakov and Esav were identical twins within the same amniotic sac. So you're going to tell me, if they were identical twins, how do they look so vastly different? How is it that Esav was red and hairy and well developed and fully nourished, and Yaakov was ishtam and meek and not developed at all? So some suggest that maybe they had what's called twin transfusion syndrome. These details are not important, but the fact is that they were literally identical twins, but the blood transfused from one fetus to the other fetus preferentially. So the blood went more so to Esav than it did to Yaakov. So Esav was redder and fuller and more nourished, and Yaakov was pale and meek and less nourished. And they're actually studying this exact syndrome now with the picture here. I don't have the actual movie, but there's a fascinating new imaging called the functional MRI or Cine MRI. You're all familiar with CAT scans and MRIs and X-rays. So MRI, until recently, was basically a static was pictured as a static picture. So you take a picture of a moment in time. But they've now developed what's called Cine MRI, or functional MRI, where you can actually see things in real time as a movie. And here you have a movie, there's a movie in utero of twins. And you can see actually, you can actually see twins fighting with each other in utero. It looks like they're giving each other punches like boxing. And actually they're studying the twin transfusion syndrome. And many, as I said, many people suggest that this may have been the case with Yaakov and Esav. And here's actually an article published in 1998, which discusses that exact theory that Esav and Yaakov were a product of this twin transfusion syndrome. The other area where you may not have realized, but others have suggested that genetics played a factor, was in the sheep of Yaakov that Lavan gave Yaakov, the Nikudim Vrudim, the sheep which were spotted and blotched and striped sheep. How is it possible that over a very short period of time, these few sheep that Yaakov selected became a massive flock? So interestingly, this is an article written in Tradition a number of years ago, Jacob's Cattle and Modern Genetics. And this is a chart which somebody in Eretz Yisrael made showing how through basic Mendelian genetics it would have been possible for Yaakov to cause his sheep to proliferate in order to have massive amounts of flock, even only having been granted just a little bit of sheep. Part of that, by the way, also there's a fascinating notion which I've been exploring and I'm working on, is the notion of what's called the maternal imprinting in the Gemara and in later sources. Maternal imprinting is the notion that when a woman is pregnant or when an animal is pregnant, or during Shas Bia, they see something that image that they see is imprinted on the fetus and becomes and the fetus takes on the characteristics of that either human being or animal or creature. That's why there's a minhag for women not to see things when they're pregnant, which are gruesome things, because a lot of that stems from the fact that that those things that they see might be imprinted on the fetus. And this is a notion which dates itself back to antiquity. And that's why when Yaakov, that notion is reflected in the Chumash also, Yaakov put these sticks. The sticks looked like certain things when they would view these sticks at the watering hole, that perhaps these sticks would cause an imprinting on their progeny. So it's a
scientific basis for anything like that?
So not in the real concrete sense where it's expressed in the Gemara and in that sense where you would see like a someone of dark skin, then your child would be dark skin, or if you see someone with a congenital abnormality, you would get a congenital abnormality. But there's no question that there is an impact on the fetus from things external to the womb that the woman experiences. I'm sorry?
Not necessarily visual.
Although there are some fascinating studies that have tried to prove it over the centuries. But in that exact way, it's not it doesn't seem to be scientifically borne out, if you will. As we shift from the Chumash to the Gemara, we find really one of the most fascinating genetic references in rabbinic literature. And that's in the following Gemara, when it says, "Tanya Mala Harishon Omeis, Sheni Omeis, Shlishi Lo Tumul. Divi Rebbe, Reb Shimon Ben Gamliel Omer, Shlishi Lo Tumul, Shlishi Tumul, Revi Lo Tumul." So this is a question of Chazaka. What constitutes Chazaka? Two or three constitutes Chazaka for this case. But this is a case with a woman who had a child that died from Mila, and a second child that died from Mila, and the child is, should she do a third one? So the appreciation here is that there is something being transmitted, that there is something connected between the woman and her child, that these are not spontaneous, unrelated events, that there's something, if you will, it's genetic, which is being transmitted from the mother to the child, which is causing this child to die as a result of Mila from some bleeding disorder. Now, if I were to ask you, what the disease would you suggest that this person had? So the answer is hemophilia. I'm going to give you a little hint over here. And Fred Rosner and others have written about this. This was published in one of the journals of the History of Medicine a number of years ago. And in fact, this is how hemophilia is transmitted. And it is transmitted maternally. Hemophilia is transmitted maternally. So hemophilia is an X-linked disease. That means that the gene is found on the X chromosome. So just to give you a brief genetics lesson here, in this scenario on this side, the mother is a carrier, and the father does not have hemophilia. Now, the X chromosome in women has two X's. In a man, there's only one X. So the woman is a carrier for this disease. She will pass on this X to her female children and her male children. But when she passes on the X chromosome to her female child, that X chromosome has another X chromosome which is normal. So that X chromosome supersedes, and the child doesn't have hemophilia. But in a male child who only gets one X chromosome, and the Y perforce comes from the father, so that child could get one of the X's, the damaged X's, the abnormal X from the mother, and in which case he will have an abnormal X for hemophilia and a Y, so nothing to counteract that abnormal X chromosome, and that child will have the disease called hemophilia. So hemophilia is transmitted maternally, but both the male, now the male could have the disease as well, but women don't get the disease. Because they're not getting unless it's possible in theory if both the father and the mother are carriers, but it's not a usual scenario. So when the Gemara talks about transmission maternally, hemophilia is a maternally transmitted disease. The Gemara also recognizes patterns of transmission in other areas. So for Gemara, it's a continuation, by the way, of that same sugya in Yevamos. So literally, the next line after the discussion about hemophilia says, "Lo yisa adam isha lo mi mishpachas nichfin v'lo mi mishpachas mitzoroin." Behudis chazik tlasa zimna. So the question tlasa zimna, does that mean three generations? Does that mean uncles, aunts, brothers, sisters? What exactly does three mean? But in any case, the Gemara clearly reflects a sensitivity to the fact that diseases are transmitted genetically from generation to generation. Now, the particular diseases that are mentioned here, I mean, do you know anyone know what Nichfin is? Nichfin is epilepsy or seizure disorder. Anyone know what Metzora is? So Metzora, I mean, brief tangent. Metzora, most people translate as leprosy. Metzora has absolutely nothing to do with leprosy. Nothing, zero to do with leprosy. So why is Metzora translated as leprosy? For the following historical reason. When the Torah was translated into Greek, the Targum HaShivim, the Septuagint, the Greek translation for Metzora was lepros. Lepros, with a small L, means just a generic skin condition, some dermatological condition. Later on in history, there developed a particular disease which was called, with a capital L, leprosy, which is a skin disease. If you saw, what was that, Ben-Hur. Anybody remember the movie Ben-Hur? Okay. So the skin disease called leprosy became identified with Tsaras, and people, there's been thousands of pages of ink spilt on trying to jive the disease leprosy with the disease Tsaras. They have absolutely nothing to do with each other. It's a brachal of Atala. They are not the same disease. What exactly is the disease Tsaras? You know, no one really has a satisfactory explanation. It could be some fungal condition, because to find a disease which afflicts both the body and the clothing and the house, there aren't too many disease, dermatological conditions that can do that. Fungal diseases can do that. But it's just a historical fact.
And the Torah isn't necessarily classified in a scientific method. I mean, it could be that there are different diseases. And it probably was different diseases.
Oh, the Metzora was like an umbrella. It was an umbrella for a number of different diseases. That's also possible. Also possible. I mean, they mentioned a lot of different physical signs for it, but no one has really satisfactorily found a current disease which is easily identified. Now, it's possible that the disease was Ruach HaKodesh. Possibly that was a different disease. So it's not necessary that it's a disease that we have to identify. And by the way, Metzora is not genetically transmitted. And most of seizure disorder or epilepsy is not genetically transmitted either. But be that as it may, the Gemara is clearly sensitive to the fact that there is disease which is transmitted, and in specifically with respect to marriage, it says you should be careful. I'm not sure if I included the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch codifies this. So the question is this a halacha? Is this an Eitz HaTova that one shouldn't marry into a family of medical conditions? Is when it says Nichfin in the Mitzrayim, is that just exclusively Nichfin in Mitzrayim, or does that mean any disease which is thought to be transmitted through the course of generations? So most people view this as an Eitz HaTova. And today you'll see. This becomes directly relevant. You have a family who has a significant cancer history. You know, we're going to talk momentarily about the breast cancer gene. You have a family that has a mother that died of breast cancer, an aunt that died of breast cancer, a sister that died of breast cancer, an ovarian cancer, and a whole host of there's familial cancer syndromes. So is that that's something which one needs to exercise caution, and that's the reason for this kind of discussion today. So let's move from the times of Gemara into the 20th and the 21st century, where really the entire field of genetics is blossomed. I mean the monk Gregor Mendel, sounds like a Lubavitcher, Mendelian genetics. It was not a Jewish fellow who established the principles of genetics, and when he originally wrote his paper, it was in essence ignored for many, many decades until it finally resurfaced. But it really developed in the early 20th century the whole field of modern human genetics. We're not going to discuss human genetics. That's not our issue today. We're going to discuss it in as much as it's related to the Jewish community. So the disease which put, quote, Jewish genetics on the map is a disease called Tay-Sachs disease. And I assume that everyone here has heard of, you're all familiar, have heard of the disease Tay-Sachs. Let me ask you this question. How many people here have actually seen a case of Tay-Sachs? Interesting. And I will explain why that is. The answer to that is zero. Not one of you has ever seen a case of Tay-Sachs. Now, if I would have been in the SMICA, how old is the SMICA program now? SMICA program's 50 years old? I don't know how old it is. But if I would have been lecturing the SMICA program 40 years ago, even 30 years ago probably, and I would have asked the Smicha students, you know, have any of you ever seen a case of Tay-Sachs disease? It would have been a ridiculous question. They all would have seen a case of Tay-Sachs disease. They all would have been familiar with the disease. They all would have had family members or friends who had probably had children who suffered with this disease. This is a disease, simply, I mean, there are variations of the disease, but the classic form of the disease it's a horrendous disease which strikes children at a very early age. They're born with normal appearance, normal development, and then all of a sudden the development arrests and reverses, and the child starts to decline, and it's almost 100% mortality at a very early age of life, you know, 4 or 5 years of age. So the reason it's called Tay-Sachs disease actually was two scientists, one by the name of Warren Tay, and this is his original paper in the 1880s, discussed two aspects of the disease. Warren Tay described the eye manifestations of the disease. And this is a classic eye manifestation. It's called the cherry red spot. This is actually looking back into the retina of the eye. He identified this in the 1880s. And Bernard Sachs was a neurologist who noted the neurological decline of children with this particular disease. In his classic article, Arrested Cerebral Development, with special reference to its cortical pathology, and ultimately the disease became names for both of these people who contributed to the understanding of the disease, Dr. Tay and Dr. Sachs. So it's called Tay-Sachs with a hyphen. Tay-Sachs, fascinatingly, is the first disease in history that was identifiable with a blood test, and it was a uniquely Jewish disease. Now, Tay-Sachs is not exclusive to the Jewish community. There are people outside the Jewish community that have Tay-Sachs as well, but there's a heavier predominance in the Ashkenazi Jewish community by a significant number. So in 1969, this is the original paper which described the blood test which could be done to determine if a person was a carrier of the disease or if the person actually had the disease themselves. And this is missing. It's just, I mean, you talk about, you know, godless habore and appreciation of a marav ma'asech Hashem. I mean, Tay-Sachs, which I mentioned a moment ago, is such an extraordinarily devastating disease. It's literally the absence of one enzyme in your entire body, the enzyme hexosaminidase A. You miss that one enzyme. What's an enzyme? Enzyme's nothing. It's microscopic. It's a little, you could barely see it. And it wreaks havoc in the body, you know, ad kedei kach that a person can't survive and can die within a few years. And that's just one of millions of small things in the body. And they were able to identify that it's the absence of this particular substance, the hexosaminidase A. So what happened subsequent to that is this is how genetics really made its breakthrough in the Jewish community, and this is when all the halachic literature really began, and this is the beginning of what we are now seeing the continuation today. So the shilas became as follows. It became possible to identify people who are carriers for the disease. And if you're a carrier for the disease, it's important to just share with you the medical facts. Being a carrier for the disease Tay-Sachs is what's called a recessive gene. There are recessive genes and there are dominant genes. And do I need to explain this to you guys? You remember your basic biology? So basically, recessive genes are genes that, in order for the disease to manifest, it requires genes from both parents. And if you don't get the gene from both parents, you will not have the disease. And then there are dominant genes which cause disease only if you receive the copy of the gene from one parent, either the husband or the wife, the man or the woman, you will develop this disease. So being a carrier for Tay-Sachs is absolutely no medical impact whatsoever. Zero. You could live your entire life with no disease, no impact. You just happen to be a carrier. So what's the nafkamina? The nafkamina is, if you happen to marry another carrier, there is a 1 in 4 chance that the child that you have will have Tay-Sachs disease. Now that 1 in 4 chance remains the same for every single child. So it doesn't change based on the children you've already had. So it's possible you could live your whole life and have many children, none of whom have Tay-Sachs. It's possible that you could have every single child born with Tay-Sachs. It's a 1 in 4 chance with every child. So when it became possible to discover, to identify these genes, then there developed a desire to test for the carrier status so that people would know before they married if they were both carriers, and to prevent the possibility of a child being born with Tay-Sachs disease. The first person, let's see if I have, I'll go back to the slide in a minute, but the first person who decided to do this test for the Jewish community was a man by the name of Rabbi Eckstein. Rabbi Eckstein, everyone here familiar with Dor Yesharim? Show of hands. Everybody knows Dor Yesharim, right? So what is Dor Yesharim? Dor Yesharim was started by Rabbi Eckstein a number of decades ago when the test became available. Why did he start this particular, this organization? Because he lost 4 children to Tay-Sachs. And Baruch Hashem, he had many other healthy children after that. But he lost 4 children to Tay-Sachs. And he said to himself, this is criminal. We can now test for this disease. Why should everybody suffer like I've suffered? Let's find out who's a carrier and make sure the carriers don't marry each other. So he designed his organization called Dor Yesharim. How does Dor Yesharim work? And I suspect a number of you maybe even tested with Dor Yesharim here in this room. Dor Yesharim works in the following way. You submit your blood test to Dor Yesharim, and your blood test is identified with a number. Your blood test is never, for eternity, identified with a name. There's no name identified with the blood test. And it sits in their laboratory. Now, let's say you're dating a girl, and you're getting serious. So then you would ask the girl to submit her blood sample to Dor Yesharim. They would then also anonymously test hers, just associated with a number. Then you submit both numbers to Dor Yesharim. They will then do a comparison between those two numbers. And they will test, and they will determine if both of you are carriers for Tay-Sachs disease. Now, there are many other diseases which are called Ashkenazi Jewish diseases, which we're not really discussing today, which are being tested for both by Dor Yesharim and by other organizations, which we'll mention as well. But for the sake of illustration, we're using the Tay-Sachs disease, and it's a recessive gene, as I said. So what they would do is they would tell you if you are not a genetic match. They will tell you if you are not, if you both of you are carriers. They will, if they give you a check, you're okay. All that means, to understand this genetically, is that you are not both carriers. That response that they tell you are okay does not tell you if one of you is a carrier or if neither of you is a carrier. So the individual does not know their genetic status at all. All they know is that they're not both carriers. Do you understand this? Is that clear? We're going to talk about, let's just talk about what they've accomplished in a moment, and then we'll talk about why they test the way they test. So here you have this graph. This dotted line is Tay-Sachs in the Jewish population, the annual incidence of Tay-Sachs. And this is in 1970, is about 55 cases a year. And once Dor Yesharim was introduced, you see where this graph went. This graph went down to here, basically hovering around zero, ad hayom hazeh. And it's very rare today that you will ever hear of a case of Tay-Sachs because people are being tested before they get married. So the question that arose when the testing was available, around the time that Dor Yesharim was developing, is should one even test? Now keep in mind, obviously now we sort of accept this as a given, accept this as a fact as many generations, many decades later. But this test just came out. And they asked the Shaila, should we test this genetic disease or should we just say, Tamim Tiyem Shem Lekecha? If God wants me to have a child with the disease, God wants me to have a child with disease, why should I interfere? So they asked the Shaila of Moshe, this is the famous response of Moshe, Yesh Livdok Umachlas Tay-Sachs Kodem HaNisuin. Even obviously it's not a tremendous number of children being born, but a fair number of children being born with this. And perhaps you should say, who am I to start looking to see what's going to happen in the future? It's not my business. And we'll see in a moment, the relevance of this statement with respect to having children with a severe disability. Mikol makom, he says, kevan she'ata nasa zeh be'ofen kal, it's just a simple blood test, yesh lodun shim eino bodek es atzmo hu kisgiras einayim liros ma she'efshe liros. It's like closing your eyes to something which is just patently easily done and easily preventable. Since if one does have a child with Tay-Sachs, it's an extraordinary tsar and burden on the family and creates tremendous anguish. You should test yourself. One should publicize this. You have a question? So one should publicize this that everybody knows about it. And there were debates about it, but obviously the testing was introduced and the testing was developed. But then the second tier of shilas was asked. For people who didn't test, or people who tested and were found out to be positive and got married anyway, and they became pregnant. So a couple knew that they were both carriers for Tay-Sachs disease. Maybe they did the testing before, maybe they didn't, which happened in many, many cases in that period where testing was just beginning. They got married, and they had a child that had Tay-Sachs, and Rahman Litzlan died of Tay-Sachs. They wanted to have another child. So they got pregnant, and at that period, they developed the possibility to test the fetus in utero for Tay-Sachs disease. So are you allowed to do that? And if you test and you find out that the baby has Tay-Sachs, are you allowed to abort the fetus? So that was the major shiloh, which evolved in the 70s and the 80s. So here you have, the classic post-scheme, these are the polar extremes. For those of you who want the amniocentesis in Hebrew, I put this in for you over here, so you guys can... the machat, the dofen abetin, the abdominal wall, the rechem, the womb, the ubor, this is the fetus. So they take a needle. This is how it's done. You take a needle and you insert it directly through the abdominal wall into the fluid, the amniotic fluid. Remember, we talked about Esav and Yaakov may have shared one amniotic sac. So you inject the needle into the fluid and then you draw back some of that amniotic fluid and you can do genetic testing on the amniotic fluid. This test has been around for many decades. So what did Rav Moshe say when asked? Imutu livdok ubar. Can one perform an amniocentesis to determine if the fetus is afflicted with a particular disease? So obviously this is directly related to the Yershita on what abortion is. So this is not a shear on abortion. I think Rabbi Willig still gives a shear on abortion in some context, right? Rabbi Orlean still doing that abortion shear? Not so much anymore. Not so much anymore. So Rabbi Willig used to give the annual shear on abortion. So many shitas about abortion. The two polar extremes on abortion are Rav Moshe, which is this shita. Rav Moshe holds his kein ritzicha. No one holds your chayiv misa for an abortion. And there's a famous discussion about why for Ben Noach there's no isser ritzicha. There is an isser ritzicha for abortion, but for a Jew there's no isser ritzicha for an abortion. So based on that notion of the parallel between Ben Noach and Am Yisrael, Rav Moshe says, if a goy is getting ritzicha has an isser ritzicha for abortion, so for a Jew it's kein ritzicha. So he holds that it's an isser to perform an abortion. When is it permitted to perform an abortion? The Mishnah says the Mishnah says if a woman is having difficulty during labor, that you can dismember the fetus in utero until the baby's head comes out of the womb. And once the baby's head comes out of the womb, then the Mishnah says, Ein dochi nefesh mipnei nefesh. Then you can't do anything. That's the famous Rambam and Rebbein Chaim. I don't know if you guys encountered that or not. But the bottom line is that Rav Moshe holds that it's an isser ritzicha or kein ritzicha. So therefore he holds that even if you know 100% that this child is going to have Tay-Sachs, this child's going to die in 4 years, a terrible, horrendous death, it is usher to perform an abortion. And furthermore, Rav Moshe says that if it's usher to perform an abortion, I'm just going to stand up so I don't fall asleep, so I hope you guys are okay with that. If Rav Moshe says that it's usher to perform an abortion, then why should you even do the amniocentesis? Because he says the amniocentesis itself can cause risk to the fetus and potentially cause a miscarriage of a healthy child. So he says it's usher to do the amniocentesis. So, and that was his shita. What was the polar extreme shita? Since Eliezer, who did not hold that abortion was kein ritzicha, he held that abortion was a subcategory of chavala, he says, "Vasher al kein kasher gilisi dati mirosh nir lefian esdaiti deish lahatir lechagon yidanein l'seder of sakas hirayon miad im hivada hamivchan habarur v'havadai shechein yulad yulod kaze." If you find out that a child has Tay-Sachs,
then indeed you are allowed to abort, and this was his famous shita, afilu ad shiva chadoshim lehir yona. You can perform abortion until the seventh month of gestation, which is unbelievable. It's not even legal in this country to perform abortion until the seventh month of gestation, but he had reasons for that. So those are the polar extremes. Moshe who asered, and the Tzitz Eliezer who matured abortion for these cases of Tay-Sachs. Now this was in a case of Tay-Sachs. The landscape, and we'll, the issue is that how does this affect other diseases, which we now identify or know in utero. Tay-Sachs at that period was the only disease that was known. Now we can know dozens and dozens of diseases that we can identify genetically in utero. How does that affect the landscape of the heter of abortion that was given by the Tzitz Eliezer and the iser for abortion that was given by Rav Moshe when we have a whole host of other diseases, and we'll talk about those also today. So now, in this generation, if you had a couple that is now found out to have both carriers for Tay-Sachs disease, they no longer have to engage in this very complex machlokes between Rav Moshe and the Tzitz Eliezer about abortion. What can they do? So now they have available to them an extraordinary, relatively new technology. And that technology is called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD. How many people in this room have heard of PGD? So not too many of you. Okay. So PGD, and I'm sure Rabbi Brander will give a PGD discussion at some stage that you'll hear throughout your smicha. Actually, Rabbi Brander and I both spoke at PUA, had a conference on Sunday on issues of infertility, and we had an entire session just on this technology, PGD, and the halachic and the medical ramifications. But how does PGD work? PGD works in the following way. This shiur is not on the treatment of infertility, but already starting in the 1960s, it was possible. People were performing at that stage artificial insemination, and they were able to harvest the male reproductive seed, and then they could harvest the female reproductive seed, and they could perform what was called in vitro fertilization, where you could fertilize the embryo outside the womb. And you can implant that embryo into a woman, and she could give birth to a child, and circumvented a number of illnesses and infertility, and was able as an effective means of treating infertility. So when they had these embryos in the womb, outside the womb in the laboratory, they were able to do the following procedure, which is a relatively new procedure. They allowed the embryo to grow to the 8-cell stage, and what you're seeing here, this is a human embryo at an 8-cell stage. Blastomere stage, and this is a pipette. This is just holding the embryo in place so it doesn't move. This pipette is gradually extracting. This is a cell which is half extracted, and this is a cell which is completely extracted from the embryo. So what they did is they were able to remove. These are microscopic pipettes. You have to use microscopes to see what you're doing, and in an extremely small. All the tools are very small. They remove that one cell. They're able to send that cell to the laboratory to identify the entire genetics that's known when you're testing from that one cell. And when they did this technology initially, the very first time, they removed 1/8 of the embryo. That's 12% of the embryo. And they implanted it in the womb, and they were petrified that with an odd number of cells left, because everything is even, the cells are always even in the human body, with an odd number of cells left, that when that child would be born missing an arm, missing a leg, with severe congenital abnormality, and they really didn't know. Lemaisa turned out that these cells are, it's called totipotent or pluripotent, which means that they can compensate for cells that are missing, and each cell has the potential to grow into all the organ systems in the body, so that the embryo compensated. And at least as we understand today, at least physically, there may be other issues we don't yet know, which may come out in later research subsequently. But basically, children that are born from this process are born healthy. Now they've advanced. Now the embryo grows to a later stage because taking out 1/8 makes people pretty nervous, and you can possibly destroy the embryo. So now they're able to let the cell grow to a later stage, and instead of taking cells from what would be the embryo, they actually take cells from what would be the placenta. Of the and this is called, you don't need to know that term, but it's called a trophectoderm biopsy, which is much, much safer for the embryo, and that's how they've advanced. And basically the bottom line is that you can take an embryo and identify
the genetic condition of that embryo in the laboratory. Now, what are the ramifications of this? What are the halachic uses of this? What are the uses in the Jewish community? So take this couple that are found to be both carriers for Tay-Sachs disease. Now, they can avail themselves of this technology. And they can go to the laboratory. They can literally choose the embryos that are afflicted with Tay-Sachs and not implant those. And the embryos which are afflicted with Tay-Sachs, I'm sorry, the embryos which are not afflicted with Tay-Sachs, they can then implant. They're interesting questions, by the way. If you have a choice between implanting a carrier and a non-carrier, you know, is that a choice that we're allowed to make? Can you make that decision? Can you ask the technician? You know, if you're already in there, you're already selecting out, you know, let's select out, you know, for somebody who, you know, for a non-carrier. But keep in mind, yes. So excellent. So when they fertilize multiple embryos and they test them all. So the halachic issues related to PGD are as follows. Halachic issue number one is, like I said, this discussion is not about infertility, but the shaila of infertility has been discussed for a number of decades now, about whether it's permissible for a couple who suffers from infertility to undergo these assisted reproductive procedures. What does it require? It requires hotzoah zera. That's the major impediment, by the way, is the issue of hotzoah zera. How do you motzi zera? And there's extensive discussions about all the different ways that you can be motzi zera for this. Many poskim, by the way, is it considered levatala? So that was the discussion back in the 1960s and 70s when it started. But the majority of poskim say that since it's for the kiyum of pru revu, it's not really levatala. Ultimately, a child will be produced. So, I mean, the bottom line is that the majority of poskim say that that it is permitted to do these kinds of things, but what's the heter to do it? The heter to do it is for kiyum pru revu. And that's the landscape over the last number of decades, you know, with rabbinic guidance. And some of you, did any of you guys take the Pua course last year? Was it offered to you guys? So you guys are not at that stage. But there was a course last year, 2 years ago, I think, Rabbi Brander, in conjunction with Pua, gave a year-long course on infertility and halacha. Hopefully he'll run it again. You guys, some of you guys may avail yourself of this course, fascinating course. I recommend it to everybody who has the time to do it. So those are the shilas that were discussed. Is there kiyum mitzvahs per revu? You know, a whole host of issues, paternity issues, maternity issues. We'll talk about maternity in a few moments. But the bottom line is the heter for undergoing these things, which are not natural and involve the isurim of mainly hotzah zera and other peripheral isurim, is a kiyum pru revu. People that are using PGD aren't necessarily infertile. So this couple who both carriers for Tay-Sachs don't suffer from infertility. So they don't have a heter to undergo this procedure for infertility. They're only doing the procedure for the sole purpose of having a child with without Tay-Sachs. Is that mutter? Are we going to allow the heterim for hotzah zera for this kind of scenario? Now, let me just share with you a few other reasons why PGD has been used and is suggested for its use. I mean, it literally spans the entire gamut. Keep in mind, it's theoretically usable for any imaginable condition which is identifiable as a genetic condition. So can you use it for gender selection? Can you use it to select out for a boy or select out for a girl? So let me share with you some idiosyncratic uses within the Jewish community. I mean, obviously, you know, we'll start with the one which I'll ask you guys if you would be matcha this or not. You have a young couple, they just got married, they're completely healthy and they're fertile. And they want to be kind of mitzvah pidyon haben. So they figure, why leave it up to chance? You know, it's a 50-50 chance that I could have a girl. So I'll go to the lab, and I'll do PGD, and I'll make sure that I have a boy. Right? So that way I can be mekayem a mitzvah pidyon haben. I mean, assuming they're both, you know, Yisraelim, and that one is not a lady, one is not a Kohen. We'll talk about if one's a genetic Kohen. That's another story. Right? So you think that's okay? Think that's mutter? You guys okay with that? Right. So mitzvah kiyum is right. So no one would agree to that. But let's say you have the following scenario. We just talked about a Kohen. Let's say you have a yes. Right, right, correct. Yeah. So in Lui Tzura, if you could do this without Hotzah Zera.
Aren't modern methods prove that Tzivah Hotzah Zera is not at all questionable? Like, when they use needles?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
There's modern methods that are not questionable at all, according to say, still yes, or in his interest, since it...
modern methods of...
of extraction of semen.
Okay, good. So those cases of people who suffer from infertility, that's a question of serious and isur lava lakal. Those are issues. So, I mean, can you do, for example, a patient who suffers from infertility and you want to identify if they have sperm, can you do, there's different ways of doing it. It's called fine needle aspiration, where you can insert a needle into the testicle,
right,
or you can do what's called testicular sperm extraction.
Right,
which
wouldn't
is,
that work for a Macready embryo?
So in theory, right, so in theory, you could do an injection. Usually they don't do that. That's extreme, because it's a procedure that you're doing, which is, can cause scarring, can cause infection. You do it if you need to do it.
Okay, I mean,
but it's not a minor, it's not a very minor thing.
So
you're saying, you're suggesting maybe we should just do testicular extraction and overcome the issue of atzva zera. Interesting suggestion.
And there are other suggestions also which don't necessarily mean... not necessarily questionable.
So let's go over some other potential uses. So let's say the following scenario. These are real cases, by the way. These are not fictional cases. The first one is fictional cases, but these are not. You have a person who is a Kohen and received a heter to undergo artificial insemination with a donor sperm. Okay, we're not going to get into halachic issues there. There's a sugya that discussed that. Or Moshe was famous for suggesting that a non-Jewish sperm donor is preferable to a Jewish sperm donor. You guys probably have heard of that, Psak. So the so he was a Kohen, and he got had to have sperm donation. So he asked the following shaila. He goes, can we use PGD to make sure that this child is a girl? Right? Why? You guys have the reason. Why would he want a girl instead of a boy? Any hint? Exactly. He's a Kohen. This child will not be a Kohen. He's going to go to Shul. The child can't duchen. The child isn't going to get Rishon. Isn't going to get the first Aliyah. So it's going to be socially awkward. So he asks, can we do PGD to select for a female child? And the opposite. You have a person who's having it. It's not his sperm. People have asked. It's not a Kohen situation. And it's not their child. It's not their halachic child. And the following shaila is asked, can you select out to have a boy instead of a girl? Because since it's not the husband's halachic child, there may be an issue of yichud if you have a girl child. Now, there are discussions if you raise a child from birth, if yichud applies from a social perspective, but if you paskin that yichud applies, even for a child that you raised from birth, it's going to be a lifelong issue of yichud problem, so you want to use PGD to select out, so you make sure you have a male child instead of a female child. What about you have 9 boys at home? You know, you have your baseball team, and you want to be kind of mitzvah puravu. You say, I've had enough already. Can you use PGD to be kind of mitzvah puravu? So these are areas, and these are not fictional questions. These are halacha l'maisa questions. These questions are asked. These procedures are done. First of all, can you perform PGD? So here you have, and I'll share with you another case also. So this is an excerpt from Nishmas Avraham. Menias hirayonim uber pagum zug sheyadua sheshneim nosim shel gene pagum shebhirayon ragil sikun gavoa sheyveled yeled im pagam geneti. Kashe, kagon harshut muhletet, congenital deafness, o shikvar nolad yeled kazel ozug, losozug, kayamas hayom efsharut, noah holedis yeled im pigamim musuyamim. So he says what the procedure is. He describes what PGD is. Nitan livdok te echad, you can check one cell, mikol beitzit from each embryo, ulavadab ezemia beitziot. Kayam mivne geneti takin, which ones are proper and free of disease. V'az lachzir li'isha rak mehabeitziot ha'tekinot, to only insert into the womb the ones which are genetically free of disease. So he writes, Yadu alisha gonav yosef shalom al yashiv shlita, and now zatzal, heitir, v'chein amar li marino v'noivert, also zatzal, sheish makom lahatir b'mikra mesuyamim. So they were matir, Rav Yashiv and Rav Noiver were matir. Not only were they matir, they went to Rav Yashiv when they set up a PGD lab, and actually Rabbi Fuld, who funds the Medical Ethics Society's, many of the Medical Ethics Society's conferences, is the major funder for the PGD lab in Shaare Tzedek. And that lab is now an active, functioning lab that literally on a daily basis is doing these procedures for frum couples that are interested in selecting out for different diseases. Now, the question is, you know, would you agree that it's okay to use this technology for Tay-Sachs disease, right? You're going to select out a fetus that's 100% mortality. But what about the use of this to select out someone who has a predisposition for diabetes? Or a predisposition for high blood pressure, or who has a predisposition for cancer, the breast cancer gene. So where you draw your lines about the use of this technology is an extremely challenging question, which our generation is now in the midst of answering. It hasn't been answered yet. And the lines are going to be moving, and more diseases are going to be discovered. Yes?
So what's the hat-trick for Tay-Sachs? Like, what's the mitzvah that
you're... Oh, so what's the hat-trick for Tay-Sachs? So what's the svara? The svara is, I guess it's really a subcategory of erapo-urapid. It's really even though it's more preventive than curative, but you have, with the available technology today, the ability to prevent disease, in essence. You are preventing disease. So the question is, what constitutes disease? And is it permitted, is it not permitted? Yes.
So in that case, you're the hetzer to do it, or you're the chayiv to do it?
Ah, excellent question. Now, I don't think it's, you know, I really don't know if there's a definitive answer to that. That segues into our next section about the chayiv of puravu when you're going to produce a child of severe disability. So I don't think anybody would say you're chayiv to do it. I think if you and I think actually I don't know if you remember in Hashem Yikom Damam I think it was the Holzberg family it's the Chabad Shluchim in Mumbai I think it's the fifth anniversary of Mumbai already they had a child with Tay-Sachs actually they had two children with Tay-Sachs they had one child before this event they actually had a child that survived them. Who had Tay-Sachs and died shortly thereafter. So that's an excellent question. Another important halachic issue which needs to be addressed in PGD, which Rav Eliyashiv addressed also, is the excess embryos. What do you do with the excess embryos? What's the halachic status of the embryos that have Tay-Sachs that you're not using? You know, are they considered a nefesh? As an isser of ritzicha to discard them, to toss them in the bin in the laboratory. So this is also a lengthy discussion, which we're just going to briefly give you the conclusion. The majority of poskim, with some dissent, maintain that the embryo outside the uterus doesn't have a status of nefesh. And there's no isser tzicha for discarding these embryos. There may be an issue of hashchasa zera. Although hashchasa zera is generally the emission of the zera is the issue. Is the issue related to hashchasa zera? Not necessarily once the zera has been removed from the body.
This would be all IVF, not just PGD.
Right. Correct. All IVF. Now, the PGD is unique in terms of the embryos, whether the embryo has the status of human life or not. So no one says that the zera of a man or a woman separate has the status of human life. The question is, once they're combined, and this is the potential for a human being.
With IVF in general, aren't there usually embryos that don't end up getting used?
Yes. Oh, yeah. There are hundreds of thousands of embryos. Now, just for contrast, the Catholic Church maintains that the human embryo has a status of full human life. And if you destroy an embryo, it is tantamount to murder. And in fact, they have an entire organization which is lobbying for embryo adoption. They're trying to have people adopt these embryos and implant them and produce children from these embryos. Yes.
Before all these testing procedures, they just in the European towns, the shtetls, it would just disease would be rampant. I mean, does this suddenly come up in America? Or?
So, excellent question. What is the history of these diseases? So it has to do with population shifts and the evolution of certain diseases. Tay-Sachs has been around for a number of centuries. I don't know the very first documented case of Tay-Sachs. We said it was only identified in the 1880s. So it's hard to tell of all these children that died earlier what percentage of them you know, who just died of inexplicable reasons, really had Tay-Sachs, was just unknown to those at that particular time. The other impact of genetics, which I didn't include, but it's important to at least mention, is consanguinity, is that genetic diseases are increased when families marry within each other. So when you marry, you talked about the shtetl, you know, if you have cousins that are marrying, and a lot of them that are marrying, the cousins are more likely to be from the same family, will carry the same genes. So if there's a gene for Tay-Sachs in the family, for example, then the likelihood of a cousin marrying, you know, that cousin carrying the gene is much higher, and the likelihood of you producing children that have that condition is also much higher. Down syndrome, there's two forms of Down syndrome. The majority of Down syndrome is spontaneous, is not passed down from generation to generation. It is a genetic disease in that the third, there's an additional chromosome, but it's not a heritable condition. There is a small percentage of Tay-Sachs, which is passed down from generation to generation, but the overwhelming majority has to do with the fact that when a woman gets older, the eggs get older, and in the process of mitosis, the extra gene is appended, and you have this the 321 chromosomes instead of 221 chromosomes.
Is the Catholic Church correct for like the Shevamit, you know, for the Gentiles?
Excellent question. So for Shevamit is Neinoach, if there's an Isser of abortion for them, is the Isser of Tzicha, but I'm not sure if that Isser abortion would carry to the womb, to outside the womb. I think Rabbi Bleich, who is one of the dissenting opinions, by the way, who holds that stems that the embryo outside the uterus still might be an Isser of disposing of it, he would probably hold that for Ben Noach it would be also. But the others, I don't think would. So the bottom line is, and this, by the way, this whole sugya of whether the embryo is considered a nefesh or not relates to stem cell research. Because in stem cell research, in order to harvest the stem cells from the embryo, as opposed to the procedure of PGD, where you take out one cell and the embryo is still good, in stem cell research, you have to destroy the embryo in order to get those stem cells. So there was a shiloh whether you could destroy the embryo to get those stem cells. The majority of postkim said that it was permitted to do. Because the embryo is not considered nefesh. But so the question is, having a child with a severe debility, so this is the state of ethics today. This is the American Journal of Bioethics, and this is your question, Goldstein. The case for a parental duty to use pre-implantation genetic diagnosis for medical benefit. So the shaila is, now that you can use PGD, is there now a chiyuv to use PGD to have a child? Now, just for you to appreciate, with respect to the whole assisted reproduction, this is extremely important to realize. Now, today, you might say, oh, you're a Jew born in the 21st century. There's a mitzvah puravu in the 21st century. You know, had I lived back in the 16th century, you know, back in the shtetl, so I could do what I could do, but there's not much I could do. Today, I can do in vitro fertilization, I can do PGD, I can do sperm freezing, egg freezing, I can do everything in the world. So maybe now I have a chiyuv to do all those things to be Mekayim Puravu. So the answer is absolutely not. There's nobody, not one posek who says you have a chiyuv to do any of these forms of assisted reproduction of Mekayim Mitzvah Puravu, and it's actually related to the next... To this Gemara, the only question is it mutter to use these procedures for puravu or not? And as we said, many poskim today are permissive, and there are poskim who are not. So what about the obligation of puravu if you know that there's a high chance your child is going to have a genetic disease? So maybe you could argue, you know, if I have a gene which is a dominant gene, 50% of my children are going to have this disease, or I have a gene which is a recessive gene, 25% of my children are going to have this disease, maybe I'm absolved from the chiyuv of puravu. So see this Gemara here in Brachos, the famous Gemara which you may be familiar with. Amar lo Yeshayahu. Yeshayahu went to visit Chizkiyahu on his deathbed. And Hashem said to Yeshayahu, Lech u'baker sachola, go visit Chizkiyahu, Shinemar, Bayomi Mahem Cholachizkio, Lamus, Vayova Yulov Yishayo, Ben Amot Sanavi, Vayomer Tzav Lebescha. Yishayo said to Chizkio, start writing your will because your days are numbered. Koamar Hashem, Mat, Mace Ata, Velosichye.
Mace, that seems like a redundant. You will die and you will not live. My ki mesa tav lo sichye. Mesa tav olam hazeh v'lo sichye l'olam haba. So Amar Leh, Sachiz Kiel, turned to Yeshaya, what did I do? What did I do so bad to deserve this? Said, my kulehai. So Amar Leh, mishum delo osakta b'piriya v'rivya. Because you didn't have a child. You didn't, or osik in piriya v'rivya. Just a brief parenthesis. There's another Gemara, by the way, that talks about, uses that Lashon Osakta B'Piriya V'Rivya, and Rabbi Bleich points out that Lashon is key. It doesn't say that you Shelo Ayolacha Banim Ubanot. It says Shelo Osakta B'Piriya V'Rivya. Your chiyuv on this earth as a human being is to do what you can do. What can you do? You can have bia in the allotted times that are mutter. And if you have a child, then you're Mekayim the Mitzvah of Puruvu. And you have to keep doing that until you Mekayim the Mitzvah. But let's say you do that, as Kederach HaTeva, and you don't have a child. So Asakta B'Piriya V'Rivya, you did what you could do. You are no longer Mechuyev to do all these other things. In addition to the fact, by the way, that these other things have risks to them, these other things have potential Isurim to them, these other things have expense related to them. So what was Chizkiyahu's response? Amar Leh, Mishum Dechazi Li Beruach HaKodesh, Denafki Minai Binyan Delomalu. Why did Chizkiyahu refrain from having children? What was his response? Chizkiyahu said, I knew, Beruach HaKodesh, that my progeny is going to be terrible. Terrible over Avera. And I said, I unilaterally decided that the world is going to be a better place if my progeny doesn't exist. Who was the progeny of Chizkiyahu Melech? Menashe was his grandchild. Menashe, arguably the worst king we've ever had in the history of the Malchus. So, it seems like a good point. Imagine a world where Menashe wouldn't have been born. It seems like it would have been a much better place. But that wasn't the response. The response was, so what did Yeshayahu say? This is the famous phrase which is used in the context of these discussions. What is it your business? What a Kadosh Baruch Hu wants to do. Whatever Kadosh Baruch Hu tells you to do, you do. Your job is to do what you're told to do. God has a larger plan. We are not privy to that plan. Maybe the plan was that it's important for Menashe to exist in this world for a variety of other reasons. You unilaterally decided that Menashe shouldn't exist. That's not your right. It's not your role. So therefore, you should have this child knowing fully well. And this is not a 10%, 50%, 25%, 50%. This is 100%. He 100% knew that this child was going to be a terrible child. And yet, the response was that he was threatened with loss of life as a result. Now let's translate that into the contemporary discussions of the chiyuv puravu. If you know that your child is going to have a disease, which is or at least a percentage that you're going to have a child with genetic disease. This is from the Igros Moshe. Ubidvar Bochur ben 25 years old, Sheyeshal Machla b'shem Tismonet Marfan. You guys know, ever hear of the disease Marfan syndrome? It's not relevant for us to discuss the ramifications, although Rav Moshe himself discusses the ramifications. Shehi ba mileda, it's a genetic disease. The goremes lechulshas halev oinayim vagidim, and it causes problems. It causes cardiac problems, causes ophthalmological problems, causes vascular problems. This is the Marfan syndrome. The gam beofen chamur shutzach kralin toach halev. The gamu iver ba'ayin echad. He's had such severe disease that he's needed heart surgery. Usually you can get what's called aortic insufficiency, valvular problems. You can get aortic aneurysms, which can lead to sudden death. So you sometimes need surgeries to correct these things. And it also causes problems in the cornea, in the retina rather, and you can get blind. And this child was blind in one eye. Ukishiyisa isha v'yolid, when he marries a woman and gives birth, Yoli bani mubanos kafi shiroin behamikrim shahayu adata, based on the statistics until now, yesh erech mechta shigam kin yesh le machlo zu. There's a 50% chance. So if there's a 50% chance, based on your basic biology, is this a recessive disease or is this a dominant condition?
This is a dominant disorder. Marfan's is a dominant genetic disease. So there's a 50% chance that this person's children will have Marfan's, and let me tell you, Marfan's is a very serious disease. Now, people can live, by the way, they definitely tragically die sooner than the normal healthy adult, but they can live well into their 30s, 40s, 50s with Marfan's, especially today where you can do surgeries and monitor and things like that. Im aser lo likach isha harui laholid. Is it aser for him to get married? Because he knows there's a 50% chance that his kids are going to have this genetic condition. O adraba. Maybe the opposite. Who cares what the children are going to be? You have a chiyuv to do your chiyuv. It's not your job to make that call. That if you can find a woman, and this we'll talk about, hopefully we'll have a few minutes to talk about it. If you can find a woman who knows you have this condition, she has these, it's been disclosed to her, and she agrees to marry you despite that fact. Because it's possible you could have children that are completely healthy. It's only 50% chance. But he adds the caveat that the woman must know. Ubarer. It's not for sure that they're going to have. About im yoldu gam cholim b'machla zu yikayim mitzvaso, they meruim lishav olam v'kashav tzar. So even the ones that are born, they get old enough that they can be mekayim, they themselves could fulfill the mitzvah peruv. However, he adds at the end, v'rak im kol anoshim haruim laholid ein rotzos. But let's say he wants to marry, no one wants to marry him because they know he has this genetic condition. And that's a reality. That's a reality of life. It's quite possible that he may not find a woman who's willing to agree to this. So what's the halacha? Then he says, Anus mikiyu mitzvah ase de peri v'riviv tzarech lisa isha she'ena ruyi l'holi b'tzad achiyuv lisa isha. He still has to get married because there's a separate chiyuv of lisa isha, but there's no chiyuv. He's an anus. He tried, but he can't. Yeah. What do you say? Let's say... No, in this case, there's only 50%.
He's just saying that we're toning down, but really he says, after we've all become halamachla, I'm saying, would this inventory, even if it was 100% chance...
Right, so he doesn't say. He leaves us to infer. He leaves us to infer. And we'll see a tshuva, we'll see the next from Yitzchak Silverstein, talks about a case where it's an extremely high percentage that the child will be born.
He's saying at the end, that I feel after we've all become halamachla, he's going to say that it would still be for a group.
Well, the truth is that here's where the complexity lies. The question is, first of all, the kiyum mitzvah peruvu is only if your children are royal holy also. So if, you know, so it's arguable whether you're going to be mekayim. Let's say if Marfan's happens to be a condition where you could live long enough where potentially they could be mekayim mitzvah peruvu. Let's say, you know, the children aren't going to live long enough or the children are going to suffer from infertility, from whatever the condition would be, so that you're really not going to be mekayim the mitzvah of peruvu because your children aren't going to be molad subsequent. You know, so would you? So he doesn't say. He doesn't say. I would only, you know, I could infer like you could infer, you know, whether he'd say maybe there's no chiyuv in that case, but it's an excellent question. Yes.
So the chiyuv of peru avu, like say the children die, asaph, but they have kids, so are they still mekayim in this peru avu?
For with their other children. I mean, will they in retrospect? Again, it's the same thing. It's a sakta b'piri v'rivya. So let's say, Rachmana Litzlan, you know, you have a child, you have two children that are roi l'holid, but they're not moli for whatever reason, then Rachmana Litzlan, they predecease you. You know, is that you mekayim the mitzvah? So, I mean, you're mekayim, but you could be mekayim. You know, sakta b'piri v'rivya. I mean, whether technically you have the kiyum of having children which had subsequent children, technically you don't have that, but you a sakta b'piri v'rivya, you did what you can do. These are famous people who had Marfan's, by the way. Abe Lincoln had Marfan's, and many people think that Mike Phelps has Marfan's. Just interesting. One of the hallmarks of Marfan's is the arm span. So the if you guys can do this at home, if you take if you measure the span from the tip of your fingers, from the tip of my right finger to the tip of my left finger when I put it out, that'll roughly equal your height. But Marfan's, because it's a disease which affects the cartilage also, they can move their body in ways which other people can't move, and their arms are particularly long. So the length of the arm span in a Marfan's patient will be significantly longer than their height. So I argue that gives Phelps a specific benefit as being a swimmer. You know, he's got a longer arm span. But I'm not going to put a star next to any of his gold medals. Don't worry about it. So what did Rav Shlomo Zalman say? Rav Shlomo Zalman also commented on a similar kind of case. Misufkani b'mishiyesh l'machla tor shatit. Regarding a genetic condition, b'tzatz av you kol yimehem b'tzar, and they will produce children that will be in pain all their lives. Oh, mishesovel mechuser krishus adam. This is talking about specifically hemophilia. Imutim mishum kach lo lakai mitzvahs peruvirivya v'lisa lechatchila isha shein abas bonim. Can they say, I don't have a chi of mitzvah peruvu, and I'm going to marry a woman who's barren at the get-go? So he says it's preferable not to do that, just to skip, in the interest of time. And he says if the couple is married already and the fear is so pervasive and so profound that they think it would literally destroy the marriage and force them to divorce, then he says they could practice contraception and not have children. He actually mentioned specifically using the diaphragm. Here's lishtamish b'diaphragm, veina bal chayv lizgarish. Doesn't have to divorce. Imatzar hu ka'amur gadol me'od l'shneihem. If the tzar is for both of them. Rav Zilberstein was asked the most severe question, severe genetic disabilities. Zug Harim, Rav Zilberstein, by the way, is the son-in-law of Rav Yashiv. He's a very prominent medical posek in outside of Bnei Brak. He gives a doctor's shiur on a weekly basis. Just came out, if you haven't seen it, with a 5-volume work called Shiuri Torah L'Rofim. And that 5-volume work is a compilation of many years of his shiurim that he gave to physicians, and it has a wealth. I'm sorry? I don't know if one of his people wrote it. To be honest, I don't know. I mean, I have the safer at home. I have to look in the introduction. I'm sorry, Rory? Oh, I see. Okay. Elena Shabeach, I know, but he has, for example, he has Shoshana Samakim, which is a whole sefer on medical issues. He has, he wrote Torah Seoletis, by the way, was Zilberstein, and also has a sefer called on Yom Kippur, all the medical halachas related to Yom Kippur, Shabbos Shabbosam, on Yom Kippur. I thought he wrote, he has other people writing in it, separate essays, but that I'm not sure. I'd have to check. I just don't know the answer to that. Zug horim shneim charashim v'ivrim. They're both deaf and blind. Lefi hameda shibiyadenu kol yaldehem yisbalu mimachlo zu. All of their children will be blind and deaf. Lahorim tinok charashim pegia kasher b'riyah. She's going to say. Eich al hayutz lehagiv ima mishpacha shalach l'dat veich b'mikre v'kimo kvar mitzvah v'mivu. Right. So he says, are they mechuyev to be mekayim mitzvah pruvu or not? So he writes, kasher omedes lifnei adam mitzvahs pruvu v'rivya ein lo lehimana mimenu mechomesh nechosav biglal shemevi lo'olam yelad she's bol v'al zen nemar. Even if they know 100% they're going to produce a child with severe disability, the child's going to suffer immeasurably. They have no heter to abstain from the mitzvah of peruvirivya. Now, having said that, he realizes the reality of the situation, that the couple it might be extraordinary suffering for the couple, and he does say that, b'shas atchak, it's mutter for them not to have children. But it says, mikra adin, they should b'hadi kafshin rachman alam alach. Just an interesting parenthesis. We talked about the uses of PGD. One of the fascinating uses of PGD is the following. There are two distinct populations that request PGD to produce a child with disability. What is that disability? Anyone guess? congenital dwarfs can produce children that are both normal height and are dwarfs. So the dwarfs who have this gene go to the physicians and say, I request that you make my child a dwarf. Because a dwarf is a culture, it's a subculture. And the same is true of congenital deafness. There are requests to physicians for, there are deaf universities and there's a whole deaf culture. There are requests to physicians that say specifically, I want you to make my child deaf, because then they'll be part of my culture. Because they don't view it as a pagan. They view it as something positive. So what would the poskim say about this, Shaila? This is a non-starter. 100% usher to do that. 100% usher to select out the child with these disabilities. Let's spend the last few moments on the breast cancer gene and the Shaila's based breast cancer gene. Yes.
What is the issue of selection now?
Oh, of selecting out. First of all, you need a hatcher to undergo PGD. So the hatcher is to be motzi zera in order to perform these procedures. So the hatcher is mishum verapo yurape to prevent the birth of a child who's sick. You don't have any hatcher in this case. I'm sorry?
Or pruvu.
Or pruvu. Right, or pruvu. Right, okay. Right. So the classic hatcher is for pruvu. So they have no hatcher. No hatcher.
You're already in the hatcher and being able to do that. Then you can't start choosing.
No, you can't. Well, interesting question. Very important comment. So PGD, for example, many poskim say you can't do PGD for to select gender. But let's say, and this really gets to the points which a number of you made, let's say you're already undergoing IVF because you suffer from infertility. And they're already in the laboratory with the embryos. And you already overcame the issues of Otsa Zera, and you already got the hatcher to do all these things, and they're just sitting in the laboratory, can you then say, I want to do PGD for gender selection? So some posts can say the answer to that is yes.
So there's no nefesh, he said, in the embryo.
Right. So the embryo doesn't have a nefesh, and there's no issue of Otsa Zera at that stage, so then you might be able to do it. Right, so that's a complicated thing. So let's spend the last few minutes. And I apologize, there's much, much more to discuss. But let's spend the last few minutes on probably, the issue which is you're all going to be dealing with, and that's the issue of the breast cancer gene. The breast cancer gene is a gene which has been identified in the Jewish community that's associated with cancer specifically. We'll talk about women. It relates to men, too, by the way. There's an incidence of cancer associated with men who carry the gene. But it's more common, the disease, in women. And that's the disease of either breast cancer or ovarian cancer. So they say 1 in 40 Jewish Ashkenazi women have this particular gene. So the questions which are now being discussed in the Jewish community and the halachic shailos which ensue are, are you mechuyev to test for the existence of this gene? And if you test for this gene, do you have to disclose the existence of this gene to your spouse, potential spouse, to your children, to your progeny? And if you test positive for this gene, what action do you need to take in order to prevent the development of breast cancer? So the gene is, the statistics vary, but briefly, they say that up to 87% of women with this gene will develop breast cancer in their lifetimes. So they may not ever develop it at all, or they could develop it in a very early stage. So if Mona Sloan, when you hear of people that are in their 20s and 30s that have breast cancer, usually these are people who have the genetic form of breast cancer. So the shilas of disclosure, that was one of the sigas which we didn't get to. There are many fascinating discussions about, these are the famous criteria of the Chafetz Chaim, about when to disclose information. But generally, the requirements to disclose information halachically apply to people who have a disease. So if someone, Rahman al-Islam, has a cancer or someone suffers from infertility, they clearly have a chiyuv to disclose that to a potential partner, a potential spouse. And Rav Moshe talked about Marfans. You know, you have, so it's interesting. It's funny, as I'm speaking to you, I don't know if people really mention this, but Rav Moshe said, alluded to the fact that really you'd have to disclose to your partner the potential for having children with the disease. But there again, that gene was a gene associated with a disease, which means the child who has the gene has the disease. The breast cancer gene is a predisposition gene. All it means is there's a higher likelihood that you're going to develop cancer. It does not mean that you have cancer right now. You don't have cancer, and you may never develop the cancer. So the shilas that are being discussed in our generation are you mechuyev to test? If you test positive, for example, and you're dating a girl and she's found to be positive, does she have a chiyuv to disclose that information to you? And interestingly, we talked about PGD. If you find out that that a woman has the breast cancer gene in the family, can you use pre-implantation genetic diagnosis so that you can select out the embryos with the BRCA gene and not produce progeny that have that gene? So you're familiar with Angelina Jolie syndrome. Angelina Jolie, a famous actress, she had familial cancer syndrome. Her mother died of breast cancer. Her aunt died of breast cancer. A number of other family members. So she decided to do the most radical thing. And obviously Hollywood picked up on this. She decided to remove all the breast tissue in a procedure that's called a bilateral mastectomy. There are other ways to prevent the development of breast cancer. You don't necessarily have to do the radical surgery. But this is a complex issue, an issue which is going to come up again and again in the Jewish community. And just in conclusion, you know, we've had a chance to discuss the impact, to some extent, of the issues of genetics on the Jewish community, starting historically from Tay-Sachs disease, issues of abortion, then issues of carrier testing, and issues of the use of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. As we proceed over the next many generations, the issues for you guys are going to get more complicated, not less complicated, as scientists discover many more genetic conditions and conditions that can be tested for and prevented. So I look forward to continuing the dialogue with you, Mirza Hashem, in the future. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask. Great. I will give you the presentation. There's more stuff that I didn't cover. Also, you know, feel free to give them my email if you guys have any questions about any issues related to the relationship of medicine and halacha, not just genetics. Don't hesitate. And this is an invitation, by the way. It's a genuine invitation. You don't get much education on the end-of-life issues. For those of you who are interested, if you want to accompany me in the ER, you know, spend a couple hours on a shift with me, and I'll so I can show you, you know, you can discuss these issues, what a ventilator is, what a respirator is, what a feeding tube is, all these kinds of things. I'd be happy to you know, to show you guys around.
Thank you.
Just a small correction. You described the way people, most people use Doryashar. That's not how they want it used. They want people to get their numbers before they enter
the Shita,
they even ask you when you give the number. Right. They never want to break off a relationship. Right. They want to be there before the relationship starts.
How do you do? Turn this down?
Yes. Do you have a card? How do we? Are you here?
He has my email, actually. I'm more than free to email.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Okay.
I didn't understand the card.